You're listening to Panel Borders, which is the extended podcast version of Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and on this week's show, Duncan Knott and myself are talking to comic book writer and now editor-in-chief of a comic book company, Mark Waid, about his company Boom Studios, who publish comics in a variety of genres, from horror and thriller titles to children's licensed properties such as Pixar's Cars and the Incredibles to The Muppet Show. First, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
Talking to Mark Waid, editor-in-chief of Boom Studios, and we've got Duncan on the line, who I've asked to take part because he knows more about economics than I do.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
For the benefit of our listeners, Mark, if you could explain kind of in broad strokes what an editor-in-chief of a comic book company does.
Certainly. Basically, it's overseeing the publishing end of it. It's sort of figuring out what, you know, setting a direction for the publishing in the sense of what sorts of things we're going to be publishing, looking at the books themselves, making sure they're all up to a certain level of craft. You know, that a lot of it is the technical ins and outs of the tracking of the publishing, the tracking of when things come out or what have you. But it really, it's just a matter of overseeing the editors underneath me to make sure that we're all sort of creatively on the same page, and we meet certain sort of internal standards about what makes a good comic book.
And I suppose it doesn't hurt that you have been quite a prolific comic book writer yourself over the years.
Yeah, it doesn't hurt that I've written about 1,000 comics. I hate to set myself up as any sort of grand authority, but I seem to have a lot of experience. So that is brought to the table on a regular basis, just in terms of craft and in terms of problem solving and what we can do to maximize the impact of this, or what can we do to get the most out of this story, that sort of thing.
At the risk of asking you to promote yourself even further, Boom had been around for a couple of years before you joined them.
Right.
And obviously the guys who set it up, Ross and Andrew, presumably knew what they were doing because they'd been involved in Malibu Comics. Andrew's written for TV as well. So they have an idea of comics and multimedia. But presumably they asked you to come on board because you have this rich history of the American comic book publishing industry.
Right, that's a big part of it. It's also the fact that I have a good, strong story sense. I mean, what I said to them for a long time was, because they were after me to come aboard for quite a while, and we were just trying to figure out how that was going to work, because, you know, what I said was it's hard to put a dollar value on what I do, because I can't necessarily bring in new business for you. I can't create new accounts, but what I can do is I can make your comics better, just because I have the years of craft and the years of experience to sort of oversee them editorially. And they were all about that. The thing that's most impressed me about Boom, and impressed me from the very beginning, was the idea that they are about comics publishing first and other media second. In other words, it's not a case of, like so many other small publishers out there, publishing comics that are really thinly disguised screenplays or thinly disguised pitches for movies or TV shows that just happen to be hammered into comics form with a blunt object. This is the idea of doing comics first, and if they become video games, if they become movies, if they become television shows, well, that's terrific, because everybody participates in that revenue stream and everybody participates in that sort of awareness, and it helps bring attention back to the original product. But it's about comics first.
And certainly there have been loads of comic book movies in the cinema recently, but it seems that there hasn't been as much of a knock-on effect from the movies to the comics themselves. And I've never quite understood that. I don't know why, when a Marvel film comes out, Marvel don't print up
you know, 10,000 copies of the related title and hand it out in the cinema.
It's unfortunately, it's a really complicated situation because it's not just a matter of being able to work out a deal with the movie theaters. The movie theaters are it's just a very complicated, full of red tape procedure, as I understand it. But I would disagree that comics movies don't circle back around to help the original comics. I would have agreed with you until a few years ago, but Watchmen has proven all strong. I mean, Watchmen has moved somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 million copies of the graphic novel in between the time that the trailer debuted and the time the movie actually came out. Forget what they sold after the movie came out. Just even before then, the anticipation for the movie was so strong that's 1 million copies of this trade paperback. That's phenomenal.
I suppose with the kind of titles that Boom publish, because there are so many publishers out there that publish superhero comics, you've got a couple of titles that are superheroes. There's Irredeemable that you're writing and Hero Squared that Keith Giffen wrote. But at the same time, it seems like you're trying to get back into the more holistic view of genre, that over the years there have been hundreds of crime comics and horror comics, but in recent years they've very much dwindled. And so do you think, by approaching genres that actually people outside of comics think of mainstream, you're trying to find new readers for the medium?
Oh God, yes. I mean, we're dependent upon that as a medium. Otherwise, we're just doomed because there's such a giant audience out there for the comics form, and not everyone wants to read superhero stories. And I, you know, one of the things that has attracted me too about Boom is that it gave me a place as a writer and a creator to come to the table with projects that are not superheroes that would have not fared as well at other companies other companies would not have been interested in. I mean, DC Comics and Marvel Comics do what they do, and they do that very well, but what they do is superhero comics by and large. And that's great, but why would you want to compete with them? Why would you want to open up a hamburger stand next to McDonald's?
Looking at the roster of titles that Boom published, there is a mixture of licensed titles and original ones. How do you sort of find that balance and, I don't know, pay attention to the number of genres that you can publish?
We sort of pay attention to the number of genres we can publish just by sort of tracking the sales on a month-to-month basis and realizing, for instance, that while there may have been a bigger demand for, say, zombie comics or that level of horror comics about a year ago, it seems to have peaked out for a little while, and so we're putting some of the zombie stuff we've been doing off to the side temporarily. Conversely, some of the straight-up adventure stuff we've had, like Tag and Talent and sort of pulp horror, but also sort of pulp adventure, that has done really well for us in comic stores and in the book publishing trade. And so we're seeing more titles like that. We have a book coming out from a writer named Mark Sable. It's called Unthinkable, which really doesn't have a horror element to it. It's really just a straight up thriller adventure, but it's turning out real well for us, and it's a gorgeous looking book.
Thinking back to maybe some of the stuff you did for DC some time ago, a lot of it felt like, as you were saying earlier, it's a good story first, and often has in the themes of, say, when you were doing the Flash, it themes of soap opera or almost romance comics in there somewhere, but then becomes superhero just because they happen to run around in brightly colored tights.
I see what you're getting at, I think, which is that it's not one of the things that does make me frustrated as a guy who writes a lot of superhero comics or things that are perceived as superhero comics is that they're, especially in the last 8 or 9 years, I think, as other genres have once more started seeing some success. I mean, you know, Sandman was a leader in that. The Hellblazer series was a leader in that, in the sense of creating a market for non-superhero stuff that wasn't really terribly prevalent in the 80s and early 90s. That's great. Unfortunately, some of the fallout to that is that, therefore, there's even more of a sort of a looking down the nose at superhero comics, or a sense that superhero comics are really only about two guys in funny suits punching each other, and they don't have to be that. I mean, they can be. It's a subgenre just like anything else. It's, you can tell any kind of story you want to within those trappings. I mean, Grant Morrison is probably the best exemplar of that. Have you read All-Star Superman?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the best Superman stories ever told, but it's also one of the best comic book stories told in the last 5 or 6 years, I would argue. And it's just phenomenal on every level of craft, and it's clearly about greater themes and greater passions and greater ideals than just two Rob Liefeld characters punching each other in the face, And again, I don't mean to sound defensive about it, but it's just you. Again, with Flash, I wasn't really sitting down to think what sort of superhero story do I tell this month, or when I sit down with Incredibles, I'm doing that on a monthly series for Boom, and I don't sit down at first and think, okay, what is the superhero angle? With Incredibles, I sit down immediately and think about what is the family angle, what is the heart, what are the personalities, what are the characters. What kind of, what are you trying to say about the American family and its dynamics in this story? And then on top of that, you sort of then layer the superhero elements in, but at core it has to be about something other than just being superheroes, or else you're just being self-referential to the point where it's, you're gazing in your own navel.
Do you find that with the licensed properties, you get the freedom to do that, to bring the stories you want and the creators you want, to really sort of develop them like sort of in that way?
So far, we've had a lot of luck with that. I mean, I would have predicted otherwise. I would have, with having been in the business as long as I have, and having dallied a time or two with licensed properties, those are often a minefield of expectations, because you're dealing with outside licensors who understand their property quite well in the medium that they created, be it video games or movies or television or what have you. But they don't really understand how comics works, and rather than work with you to try to make the best of both media, they tend to be sort of defensive and dictatorial about what the property is, and that's fair enough, because it's their property, it's their sandbox. But luckily we found, especially with the Pixar stuff, Muppets and the Incredibles and Toy Story and those books that we're doing predominantly for children, we found that the licensors are very open to letting us tell good comic stories first and foremost, without sort of nickel and diming us to death, if you will.
Do you find that having the name recognition that goes with the Pixar characters or the Muppets gives you the sales base that says, right, well, okay, we can take the risk on the stories we want to there, and sort of the commercial side and the creative side give each other that bit of freedom?
It does. It does give us a little more flexibility in that sense, especially because the books are actually selling even better than we had predicted, or at least better than I had predicted in-house. I thought they would do reasonably well. But again, our first volley, is really just selling to comic book shops. And I didn't, those are largely populated by 38-year-old men. So I had no real false expectations about how well something like Toy Story or Muppets would do in there. To my surprise, we sold about half again as many as we thought we were going to sell. We sold about 150% of what I predicted we were going to sell, and that was just in the comic shop markets. And then what has arisen out of that, with that, has snowballed into us being able to get these into bookstore distribution, being able to get these comics into grocery stores and newsstands and try to get them into the hands of kids who don't normally wander into a comic book shop populated by 38-year-old men.
Mm. You talked earlier about going back to just focusing on the comics and making the comics better. I mean, the distribution through newsstands, was that hard to break back into?
It was, and it's not, it's not cheap, and it's sort of fraught with red tape peril and so forth, and we have to be very judicious about what we come out with, and we have to be very, very cautious not to overcommit ourselves to that, because with that in mind too, that the newsstand is not exactly a growth medium. It's just, it's print publishing overall is you know, is not as healthy as it has been, and is sort of stabilized at the moment in the States, at least. And that's great. So, but we can't put all our eggs in that basket completely either. I mean, we're also exploring all sorts of digital distribution, and we're exploring all sorts of webcomics formats and so forth. And that stuff we'll be able to talk about hopefully this summer. But we're trying to break new ground there as well, because the whole point of doing something like, I don't know, I mean, well, the whole point of doing comics in general is to tell your stories and tell them to as wide an audience as you can possibly find. When it comes to the kids' stuff, like Pixar and the Muppets especially, I mean, that's, there's no point in doing that if you're selling only to people who are grown-ups. I'm not interested in people who are coming at it just because they want a nostalgic fix. I'm interested in reaching young, bright, creative, you know, vital kids in grade school, because that's the audience that will grow with you and will not just die of old age.
Which is really good to hear. And I suppose that's almost a vote in favor of, whether it's in print or digitally, the monthly comic and something that comes in small, easy to afford installments, rather than possibly the trend towards collected editions, graphic novels, and the feeling that, well, it's all going to be aimed at the bookshop rather than the newsstand anyway.
No, good point. And it's also, I mean, really, it's just a matter of, I don't really care how people consume the product. I don't care if they consume it on the screen. I don't care if they consume it as a 32-page comic, or if they pick it up as a graphic novel, as we collect these things in the graphic novels. But I just want them to read the stories. And again, I certainly have no prejudice against digital distribution and so forth. I'm of a certain generation. I would much rather take a comic book under a tree in the summertime and sit there with a peanut butter sandwich and read my comic than I would read it on a screen. But I also realize I'm 47 years old, so my opinion doesn't count. That's, you know, we're not catering to me, and I would be foolish to, you know, to ignore the fact that on-screen delivery is a method, you know, is a medium that is becoming more and more easily accepted and embraced by each succeeding generation.
Although I suppose in terms of the audience, you spoke about how people who visit comic shops are this sort of aging 30-year-old population. And I wonder if the sort of people who consume webcomics at the moment are of a similar generation, and we need to wait for some sort of device that's really good at displaying comics outside of the desktop to make webcomics more viable in the real world for a younger audience.
I think that's part of it, but I don't think that's the real tipping point. I think the tipping point is that we have yet to create the webcomic that takes advantage of all the things a comic can do without sort of dressing it up with motion and sound and animation effects and so forth, which are all lovely, and that's, I suppose, entertaining to some degree, but that's not what comics does. What you need is an interface where you're looking at pictures that are formatted specifically for that horizontal format that the screen is, rather than the vertical format that comic book pages are. So first off, from my point of view, you always lose points if what you're doing is just basically taking a vertical comic and refitting it into a horizontal medium without. Does that make any sense? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, because am I mistaken, or does it seem somehow annoying to? It's not as fluid a read if you're doing it like that. You're not designing it for what it. You're designing it for one format, but you're trying to, like I say, hammer it with a blunt instrument into another format, and it feels uncomfortable. So first off, we need to start, doing things specifically for that screen format, and more importantly, the interface has got to be as simple as possible. It really has to be as simple as hitting the right arrow key to turn a page. I mean, something with ergonomically as mindless and as easy and natural as flipping the page of a magazine. And we're not quite there yet. Some people have come very close, and there's some guys in France and some guys in Italy whose work I've seen online who are doing an amazing job with that sort of interface. So now we've got to find the right stories to tell in that format. And once we do, I think it has less to do with mobile devices Bennett does, which is trying to find that simple interface that really does emulate the comic page on every, you know, as much as humanly possible.
So all those guys like Rob Liefeld who used to draw things landscape and, you know, in the old comic format might have their time yet.
That's what I'd say. He may have just been ahead of his time. We don't know. What a frightening thought, with all due respect to Rob, that we were all fools. We were all mistaken. He was a prophet. Did you understand he was a prophet?
I suppose the other aspect of webcomics that you've been tapping into is on the Boom website, there are entire backlist issues that you've previously published in print as webcomics. And I wonder if, as they've gone up, whether you've noticed that sales of the print version have gone up as people can read the web version.
We have. Not dramatically. I'm not going to lie to you and say it's been this incredible gold rush for Boom Comics, but we have noticed an increase. The thing that has most impressed us is we went online about a year ago, and we were simultaneously releasing a book called Northwind, which is a sort of an apocalyptic future science fiction Ice Age sort of book, where that the conglomerations of words that told you nothing, but you kind of get what I'm saying. We released it on MySpace.comics or MySpace comics page simultaneously to its print version, and you know, the hue and cry from the retailers was very strong, and I understand that they felt a little like we were somehow stepping on their toes, but the reality of it is that we saw sales increase between issues 2, 3, and 4. And I'm here to tell you, as somebody who's been in this business for 20 years, that never happens. It doesn't work like that. It always works. It is as true as gravity and, you know, and magnetism and the other great forces of nature. Sales start high on issue 1 and they just sort of dwindle down with each succeeding issue. That's the way the market works, but with Northwind, and the only thing we can possibly chalk it up to is that web exposure, the print sales actually increase with each ensuing issue. So that was very encouraging to us.
Well, I suppose the thing about the internet is it's sort of a dramatic version of word of mouth, that you can send someone a link and then they send it on to someone else, which is the opposite of static media that are sort of thrust at you and you have to make the decision whether to buy it or consume it. With the web, it's more like you're tapping into a zeitgeist and hoping that the thing gets spread along people of a similar mind.
And also the only investment we're asking for on the web is time. We're not asking for a capital investment. We're not asking for money at this point. We're just asking, you know, that's what we're asking you to invest is the time it takes to take 3 or 4 minutes and examine this link and see and page through this comic and see if it's something you were interested in.
With the kind of creators that you've attracted to Boom, at the risk of playing a devil's advocate, it does seem that you've attracted a lot of your former colleagues to come and work for you.
Yes, indeed. I have good taste.
Well, I was wondering what the pitch was that you gave to them to say, you know, that things that Boom can do, being a smaller studio than the big publishers can.
That's a good question. And the reality of it is, and I'll be completely frank about this, is we can't pay as much as some of the bigger studios. We simply can't, because we're a smaller company and we're still in startup phase. And everyone understood that coming in. But what we could do is we could promise you promotion. You know, we could promise a more hands-on experience in turn. You know, because it's one thing to be one of 85 titles published by a publisher that month. You're only going to get a certain amount of attention. Whereas we, on a good month, we still publish maybe 15, 16 comic books a month, maybe a little bit more. We'll probably be ramping up closer to 20 to 25 by the end of summer. But still, with the size of the staff we have, we have a chance to give everything personal attention. And also, I think part of the pitch was that, listen, I've sat on both sides of the desk. I've been an editor, but I've also been a creator. And I understand how both sides work, so you know, you can trust me to when I say what I want is what is best for your story, which, you know, on occasion has had me running, you know, head to head with Ross and Andrew on occasion, but that's okay. That's they're incredibly supportive of the editorial decisions I make. We have not ever had a situation where I wanted to go to press on something and they didn't want me to do it. They, you know, there were times when they sort of looked at stuff and went, I don't know, but let him have his head. And sometimes that's worked and sometimes it hasn't. But I appreciate that freedom, and that's a freedom that I'm able to pass along then to the people who are working with us creatively. And I think that's part of the appeal of Boom.
When it comes to doing a title like The Incredibles, you used to write The Fantastic Four. And when I saw the film of The Incredibles in the cinema, I thought this is the best Fantastic Four movie that they've made. And the two official ones haven't changed my mind about that either. So when it comes to writing the comic, do you almost have to turn off your history with similar characters so that you don't do a pastiche of something that you were once famous for?
I almost have to, except that there are two things that are working in my favor. One is that while The Incredibles certainly had that really strong Fantastic Four flavor, and certainly, you know, that you could make a case for inspiration there. By the end of the 2 hours of that movie, those characters are so brilliantly described within the movie, and their voices are so individual and so interesting that I don't think about the Fantastic Four when I sit down to write The Incredibles, other than it's about a family. But in terms of the voices, I don't have to worry about, or the personalities, I don't have to worry about sort of pastiching one with the other, because I honestly feel like I've gotten to know the Incredibles characters well enough to see them as their own characters. The other thing that actually works to our advantage too is that I loathe pastiche with a blind, white hot passion. I enjoyed it as much as anybody back in the day, but I think everybody just sort of reaches their natural boiling point with pastiche, where after they've seen a million different lampooning comics and a million different homages, that they just sort of snap like a cheap rubber band and they don't want to do it anymore.
When it comes to writing these licensed characters, it's not that dissimilar to a position that you've been put in the past, where you're taking on a comic book icon that has loads of history to it and you have to add something new, respecting both the fans and potential new readers.
It's very similar in that sense. It is a little different in that there's still, creatively, there's still a little more freedom with doing things like Superman and Batman and Fantastic Four, if only because they're, having been in the business this long, there is sort of an acknowledgement that I have proven that if you give me Spider-Man for a month, I'm not going to break it. You know? I've been doing this long enough, and I have enough under my belt where, and I have probably read and in some cases written more stories about certain characters than the editors have edited or have ever read. So there's a level of trust that comes with that, and a level of sort of acknowledgement. With the other licensed properties, with new licensed properties like The Incredibles, there's certainly a level of trust in that they respect the fact that I'm good at what I do with comics, but I don't have a history with those characters like I do with, say, the DC or Marvel characters. The trust that I have earned is more about craft than it is about my having proved repeatedly how much I love these characters, that I'm going to treat them well. Mm. Does that make any sense?
Mm. Yeah, definitely. Right. When it came to the children's comics that you're publishing, I spoke to Roger Landridge recently.
Who is, by the way, just the find of the century for me. Oh, my God.
Absolutely. I mean, what we were talking about was how you render something like the Muppet characters on the page, and he's brought them to life by using caricature and not necessarily trying to present them in a sort of realistic, for want of a better word, depiction.
Right.
Was that even more difficult when it came to auditioning artists for the Pixar titles?
Luckily not, because the beauty of the Pixar arrangement, and this pleasantly surprised me, was that, you know, when we sat down with them for the first time, I assumed that they would want, you know, a very literal translation of that 3D look. And instead, they were the ones that came to the table and said, that's not what we want. What we want is something that looks like a comic book, because that's what you people do. And that's what you do well. And there's no point in trying to create a fake 3D feel to what is essentially a 2D image. Just do a 2D comic and do it well. You know, keep on model, but don't worry about the fact that it doesn't look like still frames from the movies. And so they've been great about that.
You were saying earlier that there's, what, about 15 comics in the Boom line compared to 85 a month for DC. there's been plenty of examples over the years of smaller companies who have got not very big very quickly, but sort of too big too quickly. Are there any lessons that you've taken from that, or things that you're watching out for as you go?
Every lesson. I mean, some of the biggest lessons we all collectively take from my experience at CrossGen, which was probably the best example of a very promising young company that started up and then very quickly got overwhelmed with how much they were trying to publish. So what happens frequently is that young startup companies start in a deficit position where they're basically trying to make money, where they're going in the hole immediately, and they're operating at a loss early on, and then what they're trying to do is they expand. They're trying to sort of recoup their losses and slowly build to a profit position. And what happens in that situation? Well, I'll make it concrete. With CrossGen, what would happen is we would be publishing, say, 12 books a month, and the boss would look at the balance sheets and go, well, we're losing money. We need to publish more comics. If we're going to publish more comics, we can make more money. But in order to publish more comics, we have to hire more creative people, which means that we have to pay them, which means that 3 months later we're publishing 15 comics or 18 comics, and we're still at a loss because it becomes a snake that eats its own tail, if you will. It just becomes a problem you can't escape, because the more you grow, the more expenses there are attendant to that. What we've been very careful at doing is making sure that we don't operate any of these books at a loss for any length of time. We publish things that are profitable, and if something looks like it's going to lose money, for more than a month or two, then we're going to have to be brutal and cut our losses. And that's just—it's not about judging the material. It's not, and sometimes it's a very disappointing position, but a decision to take. But you've got to sort of, especially in this marketplace, you've got to be very, very brutal about that. You can't sustain things at a loss for any length of time and hope you'll make it up in the long run, because there may not be a long run.
I suppose it's that upfront investment cost of getting everything in place. And I guess that might help the focus on the monthly book, because at least then if that's profitable, that's keeping things going rather than the interminable wait for the graphic novel to come out and then hoping those sales pick up.
And also, I tease Ross about this a lot, and I can do this because he's one of my best friends in the world, and he's probably the best publisher I've ever seen. But I mean, Ross can squeeze a nickel until it bleeds, until it fissions into its core elements. And while I mock him about the fact that Ross would rather drive 14 blocks to find free parking than just pull up to the goddamn valet station, we are in profit and we are in business and we are succeeding because of that. At core, that is, that is the secret to Boom success, is that Ross is very frugal, and we are our cash outlay is not very strong, and we admit that, but hopefully someday it will be, where we'll be in a position where everybody's making, everybody who works for Boom can light their cigars with $50 bills, hopefully someday, but right now there's no point in overspending early on.
You've attracted a few TV and film writers to writing comics for Boom, and that's something that we've seen in Marvel and DC as well. What would you find that the feedback's been from these writers in being able to do comics?
They love doing comics because it gives them a creative freedom that they don't have. It basically, if they're doing comics for Boom, they have to answer to in terms of content and in terms of the craft of it and so forth and the basic story, they have to answer to one or two people. They have to answer to whichever editor they're working with, and then, to some degree in terms of the initial pitch, they have to answer to Ross. But once they're up and running, they have to answer to one guy who is their editor, and basically that editor is going to try to give them as much freedom as they possibly can, as opposed to in television or movies where everybody is allowed to give notes about everything all the time, and the janitor is allowed to have an opinion about your movie, and if you got to go take his notes too. They like that freedom. They understand there's a responsibility with it that comes with it, which is that we are not publishing your film script. We are demanding that you work within the parameters of what a comic can and can't do, and that's very daunting for a lot of these guys. I mean, I've worked with a lot of writers now who are very experienced television and theater writers and movie writers and so forth, but they understand it's a different language. They understand that the medium is different, that there's a limit to how verbose it can be. There's a limit to how busy the page can be. There's you know, you can't show movement in the same way and so forth. And they get it, and they all seem very eager to learn. I don't want to go on and on, but I'll leave you with this one anecdote, which amuses me to no end, which is that there's a screenwriter who came in, and I can't mention his name, but he is one of the most famous screenwriters in the world. I mean, certainly anyone in Hollywood knows his name, and I would guess that half the people who know anything about movies know this guy's name. So he comes in the office, and I'm a little intimidated, frankly. He comes and sits with me, and he has some ideas for comics. Because he's kind of looking to dabble. And first off, I'm impressed that he wanted to learn the language. He didn't come in presuming that just because he had a pedigree in other media that he was going to have free ride in comics. The other thing that impressed me is I explained to him after listening to his pitches that these are really good ideas. And frankly, we can make a lot of money with these. But they're terrible comics. and that's no offense. And I don't think I phrased it quite that bluntly, but that was the idea. They're not great comics. And he didn't fight with me. He didn't get petulant. Instead, he sat down with me and we talked about what makes a good comic. What are we looking for in terms of comics that you can't do in movies that you can't do in TV? And the point of my story just being that I was pleasantly surprised by how amenable he was, that he didn't feel like he was slumming. Instead, he felt like he was learning a new language that would behoove him to learn, and I thought that was great.
Well, I suppose in a roundabout way, one of the reasons I asked the question was, as well as top Hollywood writers, you've got writers of more experimental films. I noticed that the Polish brothers are writing a comic for you.
Yeah.
And they made one of my favorite films of the last decade, North Fork.
Yeah.
So I guess with them, it's as much that a pitch for a movie they might have had, which might be considered too experimental to get multi-million-dollar budget, can be realized more effectively in comic book format.
I think that's true. Like I said, as long as they're willing to sort of play by the rules of comic book formatting, then I'm fine with that. I mean, Northwind to some degree was that. Salem to some degree was that. I think those began at some point in their gestation as ideas for screenplays, but they were reformatted and made into good comics first and foremost. So I don't care where the idea comes from. I mean, if you come in with a great idea for a movie that you want to see turned into a comic, if we can turn it into a comic, then great. But it still has to stand on it. It still has to read like a comic. It still has to stand alone on it. I mean, I can't imagine that you guys I'm sure that you guys know what it's like to pick up a comic and read it and know instantly that, what you're reading is really just sort of a fishing expedition to Hollywood. It's not really a comic.
Mm.
And it's a fine line. I mean, we just have to be very vigilant about not crossing that line.
Because
then you lose your credibility as a comics publisher.
Cool. Yeah, that's great, Mark. Thanks for doing the interview.
No, my pleasure.
No, that's right. Thank you. And it's been fascinating to listen to.
Anytime you guys want to call, I'm here for you.
For more information about Boom Studios Comics, please visit our blog at www.panelborders.wordpress.com, where you'll find links to their website and previews of a variety of their titles. As I mentioned earlier, we've also interviewed Muppet Show artist Roger Langridge for the show, and that interview will be broadcast later in the summer. Thanks for listening.